Hey, Mets fans, welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, we are recording this on Friday, April 28th. The Mets won last night against the Washington Nationals, breaking a four-game losing streak. Watching the Mets over the last week has been interesting because the first two-thirds of the West Coast swing looked really, really good. And then even the last two games in San Francisco, they got outscored, but they were still hitting. But against the Nationals, things kind of went dead for a couple of games. You know, we do a sort of vibe check at the start of the show. How are you feeling about the Mets today coming off of that four-game losing streak?
I'd say a little bit mixed. It what really bummed me out about the end of the West Coast trip was just that they had the opportunity there, winning the first two games in San Francisco, to just win one more. You really can't complain with a 7-3 trip overall, even if two of the teams are inferior competition. And it, honestly, right now, the Dodgers look inferior to the Mets as well. But you can't complain about that too much. But, man, 8-2, I mean, 9-1 was also possible. But you take the first two in San Francisco and you start thinking they're going to win another series. 8-2 road trip, that would be really nice. And to kind of fumble a little bit there at the end was a bit of a downer. But those things can happen. I wasn't too negative on Monday morning. Two losses to the Nationals in their current state, that's a little bit of a different story. Yep. And, Keith Hernandez talked a lot in the series opener about sort of the big adjustment. You're out west for 10 days, maybe even been like 11 days. They took a red eye back on Sunday night, and that was something that I'm sure professional sports teams have a lot more information on sleep and time zone adjustment and rest and what works best and what doesn't. I'll just say that as a very much not professional athlete, if I had to play a baseball game, I'd rather not have one night be on a plane. Like, I'd rather have stayed in San Francisco and then flown out in the morning. You still have the time zone adjustment, but essentially sleep in a bed,
right?
Two nights in a row. It's not something I had thought about too much until this particular West Coast trip came to an end, just because Keith talked about it so much on the broadcast. But you drop the series opener, and it's like, okay, whatever. But when the second game, when it looked just as bad as the first, it was kind of like, ooh, all right. You know, that first game you saw Lindor and Guillorme both make stupid plays. And yep, those are two guys who almost never make stupid plays. Guillorme breaking the wrong way on that ground ball, Lindor fielding a ball that could have been at least one out, maybe a double play, but he fields it on the right side of second base and then doesn't just go to the back to get the force, tries to apply a tag, drops the ball while he's trying to make the tag. Like, those kind of things looked like a team that was tired. But yeah, at least they didn't get swept. And I just hate that now they've lost two series so far this year. And yep, the Brewers, whatever. You know, that's a team that's competitive right now. But the Nationals are not. And it's just annoying. So overall, mixed vibes. It's hard to be too depressed given the opportunity to see Justin Verlander pitch in person today in a rehab start.
Yeah, way to rub that in.
I know
it is your constitutional right to do so. But yeah, no, it's a I think a mixed bag is a good way to sort of talk about this. My big issue that I have with the last four games, or the four games before the victory last night, was just the last couple of seasons it seemed like the Mets team has had this, I don't want to call it an extra gear necessarily, but it just seemed like maybe this is more indicative of the few years that happened before it. It seemed like from like 2016 to 2020 or so, if the Mets gave up two runs in the first inning, the team just deflated. And it seemed like they could not possibly come back from a 2-0 deficit. And then the last couple of seasons, it just seemed like deficits like that didn't mean so much. I mean, we can go to the extreme examples of like that game in Philadelphia when they came back and things scored, was it 9 runs in the bottom of the, whatever that crazy game was.
Right.
You know, like, I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about not being out of it as soon as they seemed down. And it seemed like both Tuesday and Wednesday, they just seemed like as soon as there was a run on the board, the mood of the place was like, well, fuck it. I guess we lost the game. You know, and I just hate watching baseball games where the team doesn't feel like they are giving it the old college try. And that is not blaming any particular person. It's just that sort of the feeling that the team gives off sometimes when they're down. And so that was my biggest takeaway from the first two games against Washington. Whereas like last night, even though they blew a huge lead, even after Brooks really gave up that grand slam, I sort of felt like, well, they're playing well today. They can come back and win this. And they did, right? You know, that was even more than winning, just the idea that yesterday's game never felt like it totally got away from them. That was the bigger takeaway for me. I just hate watching listless baseball.
Yeah. So this might become a weekly segment. What am I going to blame the pitch clock for? So I am curious to see whether or not teams that score first fare better in the pitch clock era than they did previously. And the month of April is nowhere near enough information to make any conclusions about that. But as someone who is not fully adjusting to this rule, it has crossed my mind that feeling of oh man, like they gave up runs, a comeback feels out of the question, that kind of a thing. To me, if I'm down as a team and looking to work the opposing pitcher and get back in the game and try to find a way to score some runs and make it close enough that the other team's got to sweat a little bit, rushing would not be what I'd want to do as I tried to accomplish that task. So, this might be total nonsense. I could be proven wrong over the course of this season, but I am just curious if comebacks are a little less common because the game's moving along so quickly that all of a sudden, all right, you're down 2-0 in the second, and here we are 45 minutes later, and now it's the sixth.
See, it's so funny that you say that because I've had the exact opposite thought about it. Whereas I have, because the total inability to control the stolen base that has come from the pitch clock, to me, like, so, you know, think back a year ago, the Mets are down to bottom of the seventh inning, someone gets on base with a walk. The old school baseball mentality is you got to bunt them over to second base or have them steal second to put them in scoring position. And there would always be 1,000 throwovers and all of that. And now it's just, I feel like if it's someone with some speed gets on first base, they're stealing second base. It's happened so much this season already. And so I feel like if it's a small lead, it's not at all safe because of the stolen base being such a bigger part of the game right now.
Yeah, that is a fair argument, but it's the getting the guy on base part.
Sure. Yes. Agreed.
And also I feel like this Mets team in particular, so like in the general sense, maybe your point outweighs the thoughts that I'm having. But I feel like the Mets are not very well equipped to take advantage of this.
That's probably true.
Where do they rank? They're ninth in baseball in stolen bases. That surprised me. Just looking that up right now.
Uh-huh.
I would have guessed lower.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's I think the pitch clock is not a part of this, right? It is a part of it. To me, it's just a question of how much of a part of it is.
Right.
You know. But yeah, it's it was definitely a weird week. One of the highlights of the weird week was the reemergence of Joey Lucchese. Now, he looked human last night, but for his debut in San Francisco, he marked the first Mets starting pitcher to throw a pitch in the seventh inning. He completed the seventh inning. He threw a shutout. He looked absolutely dominant. And I think that, you know, all of us like to dream on starts like that, but no one really thought that that was going to be who Joey Lucchese was going to be for the rest of the season. But we now have two starts under the belt, and he went 12 and a third innings over those two starts. And that is about as good as you're going to get from the Mets this season. The pitchers have not been going deep at all. And, you know, I've always liked the Cherv as just a pitch that batters don't see that often, so it keeps them off, you know, kind of on their toes a little bit. But last, especially the start in San Francisco, he was spotting his fastball like perfectly. And right. If you can have that sort of control with your fastball and then throw a weird off-speed pitch on top of that, man, that is a really fun combination. And I'm curious as to, well, let's talk Lucchese before I ask that next question. What did you think of Lucchese's two starts?
So I did not get to see the second one. So all I can do is scout the box score. And if you look at that, that's totally fine. Obviously, you'd like to not allow any runs to the Nationals, but he pitched better than the relievers who came in after him. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
And yeah, no, that first start back, he looked really sharp. Not that real life baseball is fantasy baseball, and not that I'm advocating that people pick him up now in fantasy baseball, right. But there was a point not that long ago where Joey Lucchese was like a hot fantasy pickup because he had, you know, put together a nice stretch of a month or two. And, you know, we've seen that many times before. Dylan G put up like a calendar year. We had a sub 3 ERA over the course of parts of two seasons. You know, strange things happen, but Lucchese has had some major league success, and by no means do I think any of this indicates that he's going to be a, you know, third, second starter type, even in a rotation that didn't have Scherzer and Verlander at the top. But it was just really nice to see, you know, to go two full years almost between major league appearances, to have come into spring training in pretty good shape. And if he had been on many other teams in baseball, he would have made an opening day roster. Mm-hmm. So to, you know, to go through all that, start the year in Syracuse, just do what you got to do and make your way back. It's very easy to root for that kind of pitcher. And what a relief it is for this team right now. Hopefully everything goes smoothly with Verlander today and his next start is in the Mets rotation. You know, Scherzer is set to come back on Monday as long as weather doesn't screw that up. You know, we saw updates on Carlos Carrasco that he threw a bullpen yesterday and he's feeling pretty good so far and all that. So, you know, it's not that hard to imagine the rotation getting pieced back together. But if those things all do happen in the next week or two, David Peterson would be the first person I'd send back to Syracuse without hesitation.
Agreed.
I mean, barring an excellent starting as the Braves tonight.
Oh, wait. No, I might send Budo down first.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay.
I was wholeheartedly agreeing with you, then I realized Jose Buto is still on the team.
Right. Yeah. That move hasn't happened yet. I guess Budo is just presumed to be.
Yeah, he has to make another start this weekend against the Braves.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, personally, as much as it would not be ideal to not have Scherzer pitch that Monday game, I'm rooting for multiple rainouts. I'd rather postpone all of this against them.
Fair enough.
It's a good thing Braves fans don't like listen to our podcast because they'd probably like be 500 comments on the posts of them saying that we're afraid of them or whatever. Like it's our, like we're on the team, you know? Right,
exactly. Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. Well, Peterson would be the first one I'd send down after Budo. And Lucchese has jumped instantly over those two and maybe even McGill. Not that the rotation is going to be healthy enough anytime soon for all three of those pitchers to be sent down.
Right. If we're getting Verlander and Scherzer back this week, who were the first two casualties? I guess we both feel like it's Buddha and Peterson, right?
Yeah. Just objectively, Buddha, I feel like, has gotten away with it. You cannot walk guys like he's walked them in the big leagues and escape with – what's his ERA right now? It's way lower than it should be.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I want to say he walked six in under five innings last start.
Yeah.
Something like that.
His walk rate, he struck out 2.79 per nine, and he's walked 9.31, and he has a 2.79 ERA.
Yeah.
And a 7.18 FIP.
Yeah, there we go.
You know, there are times that pitchers are bucking the trend and defying their underlying metrics, and, you know, whether you prefer FIP or some other variant, either at Fangraphs or Baseball Prospectus or wherever, you see those guys who just pitch better than what the suggested numbers say. Or even StatCast, right, with expected stats that are there now. This is not a case of that. You cannot do this. And So, yeah, he's got to go. I mean, if you get Carrasco and Verlander back, and then obviously Scherzer is slated to come back from his suspension, then you can fill the rotation with those three. And you could have a scenario where it's Scherzer, Verlander, Senga, Lucchese, and Carrasco as your five. And then all of those pitchers who started the year in Syracuse would be back there relatively soon. But I think I have more confidence in McGill than Carrasco right now.
Yeah, I feel like Carrasco is going to get the nod because he's a veteran, and I feel like Buck's the type of guy who really values that veteran leadership, et cetera, et cetera. But I would also think that Carrasco maybe should get like two or three rehab starts just to see what, Verlander's getting one and we'll be back. It just makes sense to give Carrasco a couple and just see where he stands.
Right. But, just see how the elbow feels and whether or not he's effective.
Yeah, exactly. I will say that, I wouldn't be surprised if Lucchese gets sent down and they keep McGill or Peterson up. But to me, that's the wrong move. We talked about this last time. Like, you know, I think that while it is nice to see Lucchese improving, you kind of know who that pitcher is. And I think both McGill and Peterson, we don't quite know who they are yet. We have an idea of who they are, but we don't really know yet. So I would still want to give them a little more seasoning to figure out who they are. I mean, to be fair, I think that both of them are maybe 80 to 85% of the way to who they're going to be,
right?
But that last 20% is oftentimes the big difference maker, right? Like Peter's Dave for Amazing Avenue wrote a great piece about how Peterson's slider has not been used as effectively. They have been calling the slider in effective situations for him, and so maybe you go down to AAA and you just really work on the slider. Because if Peterson doesn't have a slider, he's not a big league pitcher.
Right.
He needs that pitch. So maybe you just go in there, you just have him throw all sliders for a couple of starts or you know, majority of sliders. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can do that. With McGill, you can work on some stuff down there. Just, yeah. I also feel like Lucchese is just, he's left-handed. He brings something different. You keep him in the rotation until he shows you he shouldn't be there.
Right. Yeah. No. That's totally fair. So let's hope we have. I mean, it's not really a problem, but this scenario plays out, and that everybody's available, and you can shift them around accordingly. I mean, if you really wanted to keep one of the other guys up, you could move Lucchese into that long relief role or try to, get him a three or four inning appearance every turn through the rotation and then switch to the six-man rotation during the busier stretches as they intended to do before the season started. So There's ways to work everybody into all this.
And there was talk at the start of the season about having a six-man rotation for at least a chunk of the year.
Right. So, right. Well, yeah, no, I think it was Tim Britton who wrote the piece detailing, you know, specific parts of the schedule where there are lots of games, no off days, you know, that they would deploy a six-man rotation, you know, in a targeted way.
Right.
So, yeah, we'll see. Given how, I don't want to say frail, but given how not 100% healthy everybody's been, yeah. It might make sense to just do that on a permanent basis and have guys adjust. Because as we keep saying, it's really about getting to late September, early October, and being geared up for a playoff run. Because as much as a four-game losing streak to two bad teams sucked between the last show we recorded and this one, the Mets are still 15-11. That's a 93 win pace. That alone is enough to get into the playoffs. Obviously, we expect a little bit better out of them than that. But to be like, oh, man, things are kind of rough. Only a 93 win pace instead of like 100
right.
or more, which we got very spoiled by last year. I think it was like the middle of May they got on a pace for 103 wins and then basically sat on it all season and then faltered a tiny bit and finished with 101. I think things are going to be okay, but it would be nice to see some dominance. And obviously if they play all four games against the Braves and don't win any, you know, Panic City will have, Panic City will need to build some new housing.
Yeah. I just want to also note it was nice to see both Lindor and Alonso break out of their little mini slumps last night, driving some runs. Yeah, these things are going to happen. Again, like if they were coming off of the West Coast road trip and playing a good team and they took 1 out of 3, I think we'd have a very different feeling than taking 2 out of 3 to the goddamn Nationals.
Yeah.
A very bad baseball team.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, what is your music pick for this week before you hit the road to go see Justin Verlander?
Yes. So I know usually I'm one. I've made some older album picks from time to time, and I love old music. But I kind of made a point to try to keep recommending new things as much as possible as we do this on the show. But I'm going to reach back to 1969, a good year for the Mets. And an album that I love from Frank Zappa. I cannot claim to be the Zappa expert. It's quite a discography.
Yes, it is.
Obviously, there's other albums that I know. But Hot Rats, to me, is the one that I reach for to just throw on. It's also the only one that has Captain Beefheart on vocals for a song. The second track, Willie the Pimp.
Not the only one that get the Beefheart on vocals.
Oh, okay. See, I told you I'm not the Zappa expert. What's the other one?
They did a whole album together. Hang on a second. Keep talking. I'll tell you in a second.
Okay. I thought for some reason that like that didn't happen, and the only thing that came out was this track.
No, there's there's a whole album that they did. It's you know. Like so many of the Zappa albums, it's like a half live, half studio. Bongo Fury is the name of the record. It has like a Muffin Man, and that's a great album. You should you should check out Bongo Fury for sure.
Okay, the live album with studio elements.
Yes,
according to Wikipedia. Right on. Yeah. So, despite my lack of expertise. I love the way this record opens. So Willie the Pimp with Captain Beefheart on vocals is the second song. And there's several songs on this record that are 9 to 13 minutes long. And I mean that in the best possible way. But the opener is a quick song called Peaches and Regalia. And I just love the intro to it. Yes. It's just, I don't know, man. It's up there in terms of like best album intros because it's not... It's not meant to be funny necessarily. It's not like laugh out loud funny. It's just like, man, you're starting an album this way. Yeah. There's just a thing to it that I love. You know, it's the more experimental side of rock version of like how Slayer opens a metal record to me. like it's just
sure.
Like I, in seconds, we've established what we're gonna do here, and then we spend the rest of 43 minutes going down that path. But like you know what you're in for. It's really good. If you think you might run into Keith Hernandez and haven't listened to any Frank Zappa, you might as well listen to this record. so you have some material to talk to him about.
Yeah, I am a Zappa fan. I come from a family. My dad was a Zappa fan. I have an uncle who's a big Zappa fan. So I do not have a masterful hold on his discography either, but I do love Zappa. And this is a very appropriate pick. Do you know why this is so appropriate?
Is Hot or Rat in no. the album that you're choosing?
No. But they just found 23 tracks that were supposed to be a sequel to this. That is coming out June 30th as a new record.
Okay.
Awesome. So, yeah. This basically with the same band.
So the things I'm very glad I picked this. I've learned more than I haven't given as much knowledge as I've taken out of this this episode, but that's okay.
That's not true. No, it's just like I said, I went through a Zappa phase for a while. For me, Hot Rats to like 75 or so, that's like a 6-year span. That is the only Zappa I need in my life. I like stuff from before and after, but that is the really good stuff in there.
Yeah.
Hot Rats is a fantastic pick. Fantastic.
Well, thanks.
I am also going to throw back to an older album and an album that I think you're familiar with. I know you're familiar with at least some songs by this band. I don't know if you know this album necessarily, but I'm going with the album Number One Record by Big Star. So Big Star is a band from Memphis, Tennessee. This record came out in 1972, led by Alex Chilton, who had got his start in a band called The Box Tops. You all know the song The Letter, whether you know it or not. Whether you know the name or not, you know the song The Letter. But Big Star was sort of his like power pop, Beatles-inspired thing. It was him and another songwriter named Chris Bell and Andy Hummel on bass, Jody Stevens on drums. But the four of them set out to write like a classic. It's weird to call it a classic rock because they were in like the classic rock era, right? But like a very traditional like song based power pop record. And Big Star is one of those bands like the Velvet Underground where they didn't sell a ton of copies, but everyone who bought a record probably started a band. Like there was a song by the Replacements called Alex Chilton that is about Big Star. REM are huge fans of Big Star. There's just all these really important bands were influenced by them. The average person knows one of their songs whether they know it or not. They actually know a cover of it. Cheap Trick covered their song In the Street for the theme song to That 70s Show. So if you've ever watched that show, you've heard a Big Star song. Their song 13 off of this is a beautiful like ballad about being young and in love, and many people know that song as well. The Ballad of El Gudo is my favorite song on the record. It's track two, just a really nice ballad. Just amazing guitar sounds on this album. This was produced by John Fry. Their next stuff would have been produced by Jim Dickinson, whose kids were in what band is that? I don't know. Memphis people are mad at me right now, but a lot of Memphis stuff here. But just, released on Stax Records. Just a really, really, especially as the weather is getting nicer, this is like a fantastic throw it on and sit on the deck and have a beer type album. If you like melody, you will like Big Star. That's my bold take for this week.
Nice. I can't claim to be an expert on the discography, but I did get to see Big Star at Little Steven's Underground Garage Festival on Randall's nice. Island back in 2004. So that was pretty cool. And I've heard Wilco cover Big Star on at least two occasions.
I've heard them do Thank You Friends before.
Yeah, actually maybe three. But either way, they've you know, Wilco is among the many bands that look up to them. So yeah, it's a good pick. Maybe that's what I'll throw on as I go to watch the big star, Mr. Verlander.
There we go. It would be a real cognitive dissonance road trip if you shuffled Hot Rats and Number One Record. You know, two albums I love, but two great tastes that maybe don't taste great together. Anyway, thank you for listening, folks. We appreciate it. As always, go to patreon.com/homerunapplesauce to support these podcasts directly. You can follow Chris on Twitter @ChrisMcShane. I'm on Twitter @BrianNeedsANap. And until next time, let's go Mets.